This is Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I began this podcast back in 2011, I couldn't imagine I'd still be producing it 12 years later. When I began, I sought to add content in context to conversations that often lacked certain perspectives. Today, I am proud to say I have not only done that, but I continue to do that. During my time on the air, many better podcasts have come and gone. And they have come and gone because they didn't have the support that they needed to survive. Today, we need great podcasts, great news sources, but most importantly, we need greater information. So, using your hard-earned dollars, support the projects that give you that information. Oftentimes, those projects are local or regional. They're not that big, and they never will be. Support the things that add true value to your life. I am your host, Vymir Disogaya. I hope you enjoy the show.
And now,
the definition. Definition.
Authorities in Gaza say Israeli forces have committed a massacre in Gaza City, killing at least 104 Palestinians as they waited for food aid. Gaza's health ministry says over 760 people were wounded in what Hamas called an unprecedented war crime. According to eyewitnesses, Israeli forces opened fire on the crowd that had gathered around humanitarian aid trucks. The death toll is expected to rise as hospitals in Gaza City are struggling to treat the wounded. Dr. Jadala Al-Shafai of Al-Shifa Hospital spoke to Al Jazeera shortly after the attack.
Since the early hours of the morning, the hospital has been flooded with dozens of dead bodies and hundreds of injured. The majority of the victims suffered gunshot wounds and shrapnel in the head and upper parts of their bodies. They were hit by direct artillery shelling, drone missiles, and gunfire. All our operation rooms are full, and all medical staff have been deployed. Above all, we ran out of medical supplies and fuel necessary to operate the hospital. We hope we will be able to provide any life-saving procedures to those victims. All victims are in critical condition. They're lying on the floor. We stand helpless amid the sharp shortage of supplies and staff.
This comes as Palestinian officials say the death toll in Gaza since October 7th has topped 30,000. The staggering milestone, which does not account for thousands still missing or trapped under rubble, represents one out of every 75 people in Gaza. The UN says over 500,000 people in Gaza are on the cusp of starvation.
Ladies and gentlemen of the press, we have just had a meeting with Dr. Ralph Bunche, and I would like to mention the persons who served on the committee, Dr. Benjamin Spock. Dr. Benjamin Spock, I'm naming the persons who were on the committee that just met with Dr. Ralph Bunche. Dr. Benjamin Spock, Mrs. Dagmar Wilson, Mr. Dave Dellinger, Mr. Cleveland Robinson, and Reverend James Bevel, all of whom are a part of this mobilization in a very significant way. The Secretary General, as you all know, I'm sure, Mr. Utant is in Afghanistan today, and he had the Undersecretary Dr. Bunche to receive us and to receive the petition which we presented. Now, I'd like to read the petition, and then you may feel free to ask questions. From towns and villages, cities, campuses, and farms, we have come in tens of thousands to march and rally at the United Nations in New York, and at the birthplace of the World Organization in San Francisco On this, the 15th day of April, 1967, we, the participants in today's unprecedented national peace demonstration, although of many national origins, faiths, and shades of political opinion, are united in our conviction of the imperative need for an immediate, peaceful solution to an illegal and unjustifiable war. We are determined that the killing be stopped and that a nuclear holocaust be avoided. We rally at the United Nations in order to reaffirm our support of the principles of peace, universality, equal rights, and self-determination of peoples embodied in the Charter and acclaimed by mankind, but violated by the United States. Well, I think Dr. Bunch cleared that up himself the other day, so I didn't say anything about it. He came out with a press statement that he thoroughly understood my position. And I've made it clear all the time that there has never been an advocacy on my part of a mechanical merger of the civil rights and the peace movement. I have felt, however, that the spirit of the civil rights movement should certainly imbue the peace movement and thereby strengthen the peace movement.
Do you have any personal exchange at all, sir?
No, other than discussing this petition, and Dr. Bunch made it very clear that the United Nations and the Secretary General are very much concerned about the war in Vietnam, and he made it clear that they were very frustrated and disappointed that they were in a situation where they see for the first time a war taking place since the existence of the United Nations that they've been unable to do anything about. And he made it clear also that Entente is still standing on the position that he has expressed over and over again, and that is that we should cease the bombings, and the new position of a unilateral ceasefire on the part of the United States, which would be an initiative which we could afford to take. We didn't go into that. I'm sure he supports the Secretary General. He certainly implied that, and I think he said it publicly before. So we didn't go into any details on that. But I think I can be safe in saying that Dr. Bunch would support the position of Entente.
Dr. King, what do you think will happen because of all this?
Well, I hope it will arouse an awareness on the part of many, many people in our country, and in arousing an awareness on the part of many people, cause them to take a stand in their own personal ways against what we consider a very unjust and unjustifiable war, and a war that is terribly damaging the soul of our nation.
What is your position as to the priority of the two movements?
The priority of the peace movement and the civil rights movement, I think from a content point of view, the issues are inextricably tied together. In the final analysis, there can be no peace without justice, and there can be no justice without peace. So I think both of them are priorities, and we've got to deal with both of them as basic priorities.
Did you say that to Dr. Bunch?
No, we didn't discuss that at all.
Did you say that to Dr. Bunch?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I didn't... Oh, of course. I think this is a very humanitarian act, and I think more and more our concerns must be humanitarian. They must be ecumenical rather than sectional. After all, these are human beings who are suffering. They are our brothers, even though we may disagree with them politically. And I think this is a marvelous act of generosity, which I thoroughly support. Yes, sir. Someone over here.
Do you consider today's rally a success, Dr. King?
Oh, I certainly do. I think it's a marvelous success and a marvelous demonstration of a great concern and an outpouring of dissent on the basis of the wrong policy, which I think we followed for all of these years.
You have been accused today by some sections of suggesting that in this manner of your presentation at the rally, you are taking a one-sided view of this whole problem.
I've never taken a one-sided approach to this problem. I've always said that I recognize the ambiguity of the total situation, and I recognize that if there is to be a peaceful resolution, or if there is to be a negotiated settlement, there will have to be some give and take on both sides. But I think since we took the initiative in building up this war on the ground, on the seas, and in the air, we can certainly take the initiative in stopping the war. And I think there are certain things that we can afford to do which threaten our security in no way. And I've said all along that I'm speaking to America. I am an American. And like the prophets of old who spoke to Israel rather than spending all of that time speaking to Babylon, I want to speak to my own country. Well, I think this is just the beginning of a massive outpouring of concern and a massive outpouring of protest activities concerning this unjust war. I can't give you any programmatic action right now or any dates for the next action program, but I would just say today represents a beginning rather than an end.
Dr. King, the charge has been made that the civil rights movement taking over the
Well, it depends on what you mean by the civil rights movement. If you mean organizations within the civil rights movement, there are some organizations that are more involved than others. But certainly the civil rights movement isn't taken over. We are coming in as individuals, and it is our belief, it is my belief, that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and I'm not going to limit my concern and my commitment to justice for Negroes. I'm concerned in this country about justice for Appalachian whites. I want to end poverty for everybody. So that on the international scene, I'm concerned about justice for everybody, and I cannot afford to be as narrow and provincial as some are suggesting that I should be at this time, and I refuse to do it. My concern is for all mankind. We've got to leave.
You can see in this video from the Israeli military the crowds of people around these trucks. But what appears to have happened is that the Israeli military opened fire on some of these people who are surrounding these trucks. Now, eyewitnesses on the scene have told us that Israeli tanks as well as drones opened fire on this crowd, and that following that, there was a chaotic scene.
In yet another appalling war crime that will, of course, receive cover by the United States government, Israeli forces fired on a crowd of Palestinian civilians who were crowding a humanitarian aid truck desperately seeking food in northern Gaza. Now, it's important to keep in mind that we are talking about northern Gaza, which has effectively been cut off from any humanitarian aid. We're talking about people who did not evacuate to the south. Humanitarian aid organizations have had a lot of difficulty reaching them. And since they swarmed the humanitarian aid truck, the IDF took it as an opportunity to fire at them, killing hundreds of people. Now, the death toll is very likely to change, but more than 100 people have been reported killed as a result of this. The death toll in Gaza is believed to have surpassed 30,000 people at this point. Now, Israeli officials acknowledge that troops opened fire, saying they did so after the crowd approached in a threatening way. The officials insisted on anonymity to give details about what happened after the military said in a statement that dozens were killed and injured from pushing, trampling, and being run over by the trucks. So, the IDF and the Israeli government would have you believe that no, we didn't shoot at them. Yes, these bullet-riddled bodies laying on the floor do exist, but that wasn't us. It was the trampling that caused these deaths. Complete and utter BS. And hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are believed to remain in northern Gaza, and many have been reduced to eating animal fodder to survive. The UN says that 1 in 6 children under 2 in the north suffer from acute malnutrition and wasting. And the UN also says that a quarter of Gaza's, and this is the entire Gaza Strip, a quarter of Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinians face starvation. Around 80% have fled their homes. And I want to go to what witnesses said about what was happening at the scene before I go to you, Cenk. So Kamel Abu Nahel, who was being treated for a gunshot wound at Shifa Hospital, said that he and others went to the distribution point in the middle of the night because they heard that there would be food. They've been eating bird food. They've been eating animal fodder. They're desperate for food. So they show up and he says, "We've been eating animal feed for 2 months, so you can imagine how hungry they are." He said Israeli troops opened fire on the crowd as people pulled boxes of flour and canned goods off the trucks, causing them to scatter, with some hiding under cars. After the shooting stopped, people went back to the trucks and the soldiers opened fire again. He was shot in the leg and fell over, and then a truck ran over his leg as it sped off, he said. Ala Abu Daye, a witness of that violence, said that Israeli troops opened fire and also that a tank fired a shell. Those attempting to deliver humanitarian aid tried to get away from the shooting and the danger that was being caused as a result of the IDF firing at them. And as a result, they unfortunately did end up running some people over. But do not make the mistake of buying into the lies and propaganda by the Israeli government. That is not the main reason why people were killed. In fact, Jeremy Diamond at CNN, who's done some excellent reporting on the ground, has a report that I want to share with you all in regard to this episode. Let's watch.
Our eyewitnesses on the ground indicate that it was the Israeli gunfire that prompted some of those trucks to flee the scene and in the process run over some of these individuals. But we are still working to gather additional details. The Israeli military says for its part that the incident is under review. And they are also saying in a statement that Gazan residents surrounded the trucks, looted the supplies being delivered, and that during the incident, dozens of Gazans, they say, were injured as a result of pushing and trampling. This was clearly more than just pushing and trampling. And we have eyewitnesses making very clear that the Israeli military did indeed open fire on these individuals.
So desperate people seeking flour, anything, any sustenance, considering the fact that they have been left to starve to death. And as they're, you know, swarming the humanitarian aid convoy, the trucks, they get fired at by the IDF.
So
who are the animals?
Yeah.
Who are the animals, Cenk? Who are the animals? Because
yeah.
I'm getting real sick of people on social media referring to Palestinian civilians as animals. Because every story that we've covered, everything that we've investigated and looked into, does not really show Palestinians behaving as animals. It shows the IDF behaving as animals. People who feel real good about themselves shooting their weapons at desperate people as they swarm a humanitarian aid truck. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
So latest numbers are 112 dead, 760 injured. 576,000 Palestinians are now starving. And this is what starving looks like. Now the Israelis say, or it's confirmed by international news outlets like CNN, that the Israelis fired from the tanks and from drones. And they said they were worried about their troops. Where were the troops? Inside the tanks? They weren't in the drones. So the guys that were inside tanks were slightly concerned, I guess, about their, this is the best case scenario for Israel that I'm laying out, about their safety within the tank. So they murdered 112 people at least. And when you started firing into the crowd, what did you think was going to happen? Other than the slaughter from your bullets, that hungry, desperate crowd, of course, was going to panic when you started spraying the place with bullets, and the trucks were going to panic. And you knew that that would also create a stampede. And the drones, how about the drones? Were the drones afraid that they were going to, that their hardware or plastic was going to get attacked? So somehow they were going to jump up and grab a drone with no one inside of it? And why would that be a concern? Why are you murdering people with drones when you actually see them and you see that they are not at all fighters and they are people desperate for food and Israel murders them. So if that breaks your heart, good, you still have one. You still have one, good. If you say it breaks your heart to hear me say it, as opposed to the fact that Israel is actually doing it and actually murdering those people, then there's something wrong with you. You think, I don't care about those people, I don't view Palestine. You have to admit it. If you don't think that it's that big a deal and that Israel is right, especially in this instance, if you think Israel's right and you trust your beloved terrorist IDF, and you look at them murdering those people in cold blood as they're starving them, as they're keeping them in a ghetto and a camp, and you look at that and go, no, the problem is people reporting that fact. It's not the fact, the problem is not us doing it. Our beloved, beloved democracy ally Israel. Is this what a democracy looks like? Is this what an ally looks like? Is this what decency or morality looks like? This is now one of the sickest governments in the whole world. In my whole lifetime, I've never seen slaughter like this on live television. Yeah, I know this Bashar al-Assad, Kim Jong-un, Saddam Hussein, etc. have done terrible things. But these are being televised, brothers and sisters. So you could say, hey, well, that doesn't.
And defended by our government. That's okay. The important thing to remember.
Okay.
Because
okay.
I don't remember the US government defending the chemical weapons attacks that Bashar al-Assad was doing.
In fact, we bombed Bashar al-Assad. We bombed Saddam Hussein. We threatened to bomb Kim Jong-un. We applaud Israel and give them money.
And weapons.
Right now, the Senate already passed a bill to send $14 billion for more slaughter. It's a slaughterhouse in Gaza. Every day that we delay, the IDF murders more Palestinians. Today, Lloyd Austin, our Secretary of Defense, admitted in testimony in Congress, Israel has murdered more than 25,000 women and children. Women and children. Remember that our hearts broke and we said it on this show for 36 babies that were killed in Israel, 36 children. And that should break your heart. You've got 25,000 dead babies, children, women stacked on top of one another. And now 576,000 people murdered that are starving and desperate and eating animal fodder. What kind of sick maniacs do this? Terrorists do this. Benjamin Netanyahu is 100% a terrorist and one of the worst terrorists of my lifetime. 25 times the terrorist that Hamas is. Definitely a terrorist. And don't give me this nonsense that, oh, when Arabs do it or when Muslims do it and when the powerless do it, they're no good scumbag terrorists. But when a state does it, a so-called ally does it, and they do it 25, 30 times worse. No, no, angels, they had to do it. No, you cannot be in favor of this. If you're in favor of this, you have lost your soul. You have lost your morality. You have lost decency. The IDF now is the largest terrorist organization in the world. If you say, oh no, that's not fair, that's not fair. We were just murdering 30,000 of them and starving them and humiliating them and shooting them with drones and treating them like animals. But you don't get to call us names. You don't get to call us names. No, I do get to call you names. Israel's one of the worst governments on earth right now. And if you care about Israel, and I think people are so blinded by their bias. But if you say the Palestinians, who gives a goddamn about them? Murder, murder, murder them. Who cares about the Palestinians? We have a right to defend ourselves. Get the hell out of here. That defense ended months and months and months ago. This is just brutality and savagery. So if it breaks your heart to hear the truth, good, do something about it. And so if you don't mind murdering Palestinians and treating them like animals, how about Israel? Listen, you fools, you utter fools, the right-wing government of Israel, our stupid monsters in our Congress. Do you not understand? We are all seeing this. Your lies about how Israel has to do it, doesn't, no one believes it. No one other than the propaganda-filled, bias-filled heads in Washington. The rest of us, look at it.
And what do you think's happening? What do you think the world thinks about Israel now? Do you not get it, you schmucks? You unbelievable idiots. If Turkey was doing this, when Turkey did, what, 1% of this, I was furious. Because it's gonna make people hate me. Do you not get it? Are you so thick-headed you can't get it? The world now despises Israel because of this. No, it's because we're the victims. Who looks at that tape and says the Palestinians are not the victims? The Israelis murdering them are the victims? You would have to be a lunatic to believe that.
As a scholar of war studies and a clinical psychologist who has spent a career fathoming psychological suffering, I often ask myself, are there any greater human anguishes than those caused by war? For the sheer scope of grief and wasted human potential, we have a moral obligation to understand the ultimate reasons why we destroy one another. Fields as varied as economics, political science, religious studies have all tried to explain war. But still, how many of us have reflected on the cruelties of war, or have lived them, and simply shaken our heads in disbelief? Perhaps it is time for a new lens. I suggest the evolutionary sciences, fields that explain the evolved purpose, the why of a particular behavior, including warfare. At their core, those explanations are not about money or politics or religion. They are about us as creatures of biology, programmed by natural selection to compete for survival and reproduction. To benefit from the wisdom of these sciences, we must first avoid what is known as the naturalistic fallacy, the mistaken idea that just because we may have an instinct for something, that instinct is necessarily moral, desirable, or inevitable. Often our instincts are none of those things, and in many cases, we have the power to choose, but much, much more so when we understand, and when we take an unflinching look in the mirror at who we are. Now, in our world, the single biggest predictor of violence is a simple demographic. And that demographic is men. Now, this doesn't mean that all men are violent, but the vast majority of every conceivable kind of violence, from spousal abuse to gang fights to world wars, is committed by men. Now, it is true that men will go to war for honor, for patriotism, to protect their homelands or their brothers in arms. But there is another ancient and powerful reward for war that lingers, mostly subconsciously, in the evolved minds of men, and that is, brace yourselves, sex. To see how this can be, first some basic facts about our reproductive psychology. A highly robust international finding is that men and women engage in different reproductive strategies. Across every culture on earth, men, on average, tend to prefer more sexual partners as compared to women. Women invest more in their offspring, so women tend to be far choosier. Now, this says nothing as to whether men or women should have these preferences or can want something different. They can. But just like other male animals, men's reproductive fitness is directly related to a number of copulations. Theoretically, a man can reproduce with every sexual encounter, and this is not a biological reality for women. There is a problem with all of this male demand. Men produce sperm by the millions and well into old age. By comparison, women's reproductive resources are scarce, limited to 500 total ova across the lifespan, to the period between adolescence and menopause, by things like pregnancy and polygyny, where powerful men hoard women, creating shortages in the mating pool. To use the idiom of economics, in the natural world where demand is high and supply is low, we have instinctual competition, and often that competition is violent. Now, it's often hard to see our instincts because typically the older the instinct, the more hidden it is from our everyday conscious awareness. One way to overcome this instinct blindness is to first observe the instinct expressed in another animal. Most male mammals, Countless monkey species and all of the great apes engage in violent competition over females. Male baboons attack each other with dagger-like canines to win groups of females. Male gorillas also square off to fight for sexual supremacy. But for a look at male mate competition occurring at the group level, we turn to our closest relatives. Robust chimpanzees will form all-male war parties, silently patrol the edges of their territory. If they encounter a smaller party from the rival troop, they tear them to pieces. Enough successful patrols, and all males from the rival group are killed. Its territory, its food, and most critically, its females are absorbed, increasing male reproductive opportunity. Male chimpanzees have a reproductive incentive for making war. But do men have a reproductive incentive for war? Could it really be about sex? Or did this nearly universal male behavior somehow bypass men? To begin, the Guinness Book World Record holder for number of offspring goes to a Moroccan sultan who was called Ismail the Bloodthirsty. In the 1700s, Ismail sired 888 children and kept more than 500 concubines. How did Ismail achieve this record? By raiding his neighbors, slaughtering thousands upon thousands of men, and capturing their women. Archaeological evidence suggests this behavior is very ancient. Prehistoric massacre sites have been found where among all the bashed up skulls and bones, there was a noted absence of specifically reproductive age females, suggesting these Stone Age women were not killed, but taken captive. We see this impulse arising unconsciously in the modern day, in societies where polygyny is allowed, where again, the percentage of available females is constrained, we see more revolutions. When there are women shortages, young men instinctively start making war against the male dominance hierarchy. Even more directly, in hunter-gatherer societies, tribesmen will raid their neighbors, skewer all the men with arrows, and take the women as their wives. And on a much broader scale, that terrible practice of wartime rape is staggeringly common. For example, during the Bosnian genocide, there were an estimated 50,000 rapes. The Rwandan genocide, 250,000. And in World War II, when the Red Army invaded Berlin, they raped 2 million German women. Now, this doesn't mean that all men join the military with the intent to rape, to pillage, and to plunder. I can tell you, they do not. But the ease with which many men will rape in wartime is telling, as are the very harsh punishments that militaries must employ to prevent it. So taking a step back, in wartime, we have male primates killing their male rivals and reaping the sexual rewards. A chilling pattern that we know from our closest primate relatives. Now, this isn't always conscious. Sometimes it is. ISIS and Boko Haram are two current day examples of men going to war with the explicit intention of killing their rivals and taking their women as the spoils of war. And they are also an example of male mate competition driving even so-called holy wars. Consider that everyone of the 9/11 hijackers believed that by killing himself in jihad, his dominant male God would grant him 72 virgins in the afterlife. This impulse is old, and it's not restricted to any particular religion. According to the Bible, in battle, God commands Moses to order his men to go to the rival tribe, kill all the men, kill all the boys, kill all the women who have slept with a man, and save for yourself every girl who has never slept with a man. So, what do we do with all this knowledge? How do we manage the most basic and primal reproductive impulses driving men to kill? for all that they have to tell us about why we do what we do. We must ensure that the evolutionary sciences have a protected voice at the policy table. Throughout our history, men have dominated positions of political power. It should come as no surprise that men's reproductive imperatives get expressed in the political realm, in the ways that we handle conflicts with other nations. Now, there is no question at all that militaries provide something invaluable, protection. But there is another ancient and powerful reward for war that lingers subconsciously in the minds of men. When women express their reproductive imperatives in the political realm, they get expressed differently than men's. Because evolutionarily, women would hardly have benefited from tearing into the rival village, killing all the women, and having sex with as many men as possible. Accordingly, when the ratio of women in government increases, nations are less likely to use military force to solve conflicts with other nations. Military spending goes down, and we see greater political stability. Across our species history, women's biggest evolutionary challenge has been rearing incredibly vulnerable human offspring. Accordingly, when more women govern, we see greater access to things like healthcare and education, which benefits not only children, but everybody. So if stability is the goal, then all of this makes a very strong case for not only carefully considering how our reproductive psychology gets expressed unconsciously in the political realm, but also for clearing the way for more women into positions of governance for the survival instincts that they bring. But before we can even begin, we must be truthful about what we are. We are organic beings with finite lifespans and instincts that we inherited from our primate ancestors. To many, these facts can be unsettling. Even in the United States, still today, the very topic of evolution by natural selection is incredibly controversial, greatly for what it may say about us. As mortal beings, not above, but related to all other life on this earth, and consigned to the same fates. But as history shows us over and over and over again, the consequences of not understanding are far worse than the discomfort of knowing. We must also see that while we are sometimes prone to do terrible things to one another, we are also capable of great compassion and great unity, unlike any other species. Natural selection provided us with these capabilities as well. Lastly, if there's anything that we can say about us humans, is that our greatest adaptation is in fact transcending our biology. Every piece of technology that you can imagine, from the simplest household items to entire fields such as medicine or computing or engineering, are all evidence of this. Transcending our impulses for war is also within our reach. But for this, we must bring our instincts into the light of scrutiny with great courage and great honesty. Only then will we be able to decide which of them continues to serve us and which of them should be left behind on the savannas of our ancestors. Thank you.
I call now, as my first witness, Mr. Benjamin Natar.
Mr. Natar, welcome to the Advocate.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mr. Natar is a graduate of MIT. He is an Israeli, and he is a man who has written widely on this question before the House tonight. Mr. Natar, is the issue of self-determination the core of the conflict in the Middle East?
No, I don't believe it is. The real core of the conflict is the unfortunate Arab refusal to accept the state of Israel. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, for For 20 years, the Arabs had both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And if self-determination were, as they now say, the core of the conflict, they could have easily established a Palestinian state then, but they didn't.
When did the issue arise then?
Well, for 20 years, we didn't hear a word about self-determination. And in fact, what we did hear, those of us living in the Middle East, was about driving the Jews into the sea. Now, after 1967, under the leadership of the PLO, the hardline strategy shifted to adopting a moderate, dressed-up slogan, which now talked in terms of first a secular democratic state and then replaced it with Palestinian self-determination. But what this really means, contrary to what Mr. Arouri said about 1977 being a changed year in the PLO's objectives, let me quote you what the PLO Information Office said in a Dutch paper in 1977, in May 5th.
77?
May 5th, 1977, yes. The statement was very simple. Our objective remains the destruction of the Zionist state of Israel. So let's keep in mind that what we're talking about here is not the attempt to build a state, but to destroy one.
Do the Palestinians have a right to a separate state?
Well,
Mr. Jam has been talking about human rights.
Well, I think that it's, no, I don't think they do, but I think that it's quite instructive that the Palestinians who are invoking the right of self-determination, which is an attribute for separate nations, themselves are the ones who define themselves as part of the Arab nation. Now, no one is denying that there are Palestinian Arabs. There's a very distinguished Palestinian Arab sitting right next to me. But the Palestinians themselves, in the Palestinian National Covenant, the very first article, say that the people of Palestine, quote, are part of the Arab nation. Well, let's look at the Arab nation. It has 21 states, an area roughly the size of the United States, and 1/6 of the entire world's wealth. Now, add to that the fact that there already exists a Palestinian state, and that is Jordan, 60% of whose population is Palestinian. I think it's quite interesting that Yasser Arafat and King Hussein, who are bitter enemies, agree on one thing, that Jordan is a Palestinian state. So what we're talking about is a demand for a 22nd Arab state and a second Palestinian state.
What should be done with the Palestinians on the West Bank? There's a problem, so what should be done about it, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the Palestinians in the West Bank are going to be offered the full human rights, the full civil rights, as there are no Arabs are offered in the Middle East. No Arabs whatsoever have any full human rights or the right to vote for their own government. Those Arabs who lived in Israel in the pre-67 boundaries are the only Arabs in the Middle East who offer that right, and I'm all in favor of having the same Arabs living in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip being offered such a right in the final peace agreement.
Can we have peace in the Middle East?
Very briefly, please.
Yes, I sincerely hope so. Look, I'm 28 years old. I've had to defend my country in two wars and in many battles. Nobody wants peace more than Israel. But the stumbling block to the road for peace is this demand for a PLO state, which will mean more war, which will mean more violence in the Middle East. And I think, I sincerely believe, if this demand is abandoned, we can have real and genuine peace.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Fagan. Now we'll go to Mr. Adame. Mr. Adame, some questions for Mr. Netai.
Mr. Netai, you've told everyone that the Palestinians on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip will enjoy full human rights. Could you tell me how that's compatible with the presence of Israeli forces in their midst?
Well, the Arabs living now under, the Arabs who lived in Israel, 400,000 of them, 400,000, between 1948 and 67, as I said earlier, certainly enjoy full human rights. And as I said, they're the only ones.
I'm not talking about the Arabs in Israel. I'm talking about the Arabs on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
If you let me, I'll answer your question, Mr. Ajami, please. The Arabs living in Israel are the only ones who are entitled to vote for their governments, the only ones who have representative in a parliament in the entire Middle East. Now, it's true that the West Bank and the Gaza Strip are now undergoing a period of transition. In fact, no Arab government has been willing to negotiate so far about this period of transition. And I think that when this transition, when negotiation period is ended, there is no reason why under either Jordanian citizenship or Israeli citizenship, these Arabs will not have the full human rights, the right to vote for their representatives, as the Arabs in Israel do, as hopefully all the Arabs in the Middle East will do someday.
Mr. Netai, does the state of Israel itself accept that the people on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have the right to vote on whatever future they choose?
Well, Mr. Ajami, I just outlined that in the event that this negotiation process will continue, I'm sure that what we're talking about is, in fact, eventual citizenship of some kind, either Jordanian or Israeli or in any other arrangement, in which these people will certainly vote.
Mr. Netai, you've given yourself the right to determine that you are an Israeli, but you've also given yourself the right to negate the other entity, which I think is not somehow consistent with global practice at this time, is it?
Mr. Ajami, I have never, never rejected another entity, nor have I ever declared my intent to destroy it, least of all the Palestinian Arabs, who I fervently want to live in peace with. All I'm saying is that it is the Palestinian Arabs themselves, their leaders, Arafat, Mohsen, who Morris Abrams quoted earlier, Farouk Kaddoumi, the number two man in the PLO, these are the ones who say they are part of the Arab nation. These are the ones who say they already have a Palestinian state. There is no right to establish a second one on my doorstep, which will threaten my existence. There is no right whatsoever.
Okay, Mr. Netai, you seem like a very patriotic Israeli. Does not the fact of Israeli dependence upon the U.S. in order to maintain its occupation on the West Bank and the Gaza, does this not trouble you at all?
Mr. Ajami, you asked me as a patriotic Israeli, and I'll answer as someone who has fought in the Middle East. One of the things that I think is unique about Israel, in terms of all Americans' allies, all America's allies, is that it is perhaps the only one who has taken care of itself so far. And I would think that America, in fact, it's not a one-way street, Israel taking from the United States. Israel is giving the United States an extraordinary bargain in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It's the one stable democratic ally which the United States can count on.
Mr. Netai, inasmuch as you're a Zionist and are committed to a Jewish state, given the fact that demographic predictions tell us that there will be an Arab majority within the current borders of Israel, does this not challenge the foundations of the very state which you are committed to?
I know of the latest population figures that actually show a decrease in the Arab birth rate, particularly in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as a result of the higher education and the universal education for women that didn't exist prior to Israel, prior to 1967. Now, if you ask me, would I reject Palestinians or Arabs living in our midst? Ridiculous. Of course not. They're citizens of Israel.
No, I'm talking about the West Bank and Gaza. You see, we're still going back to the core of it.
Yes, I agree. Whatever will be the final arrangement, these people should be free to multiply as they wish. I think that it is written in the Bible, multiply and be fruitful. I think these people should have that right. I'm not going to start enforcing a birth control program under any circumstance.
Thank you. With that biblical injunction, I came to Mr. Abram, one more question for Mr. Netai.
Mr. Netai, since the subject is what should the United States do, may I ask you if you could summarize why, in your opinion, the United States should oppose the creation of a PLO state?
I think the United States should oppose the creation of a Palestinian state for several reasons. The first one being that it is unjust to demand the creation of a 22nd Arab state and a second Palestinian state at the expense of the only Jewish state. I think it also would defeat the hopes of those moderate Palestinians who genuinely want to reach a peace accommodation with Israel.
Thank you. Mr. Ajami, another question.
Mr. Netai, as someone who would say that you believe in democracy, do you believe that Israel can continue as a garrison state and still remain a democratic state?
Mr. Ajami, either you didn't hear what I said before, or for your benefit, I'll repeat it again. No, Israel does not intend to remain a garrison state. Israel wants to live in peace and wants to be secure. If that involves maintaining military guarantees, our own military guarantees against the destruction of people who surround us, yes, I believe we should fight for our survival. If I have to, I'll fight again, but I hope not to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ajami.
Mr. Netai, thank you for joining us.
We are trying to sell peace like a product, you know, and sell it like people sell soap or soft drinks. And it's the only way to get people aware that peace is possible and isn't just inevitable to have violence. John Lennon. The belief in a just war was developed in Christian circles because authorities found a tension between Jesus' promotion of non-violence and violence being necessary in certain situations. Augustine of Hippo and Thomas Aquinas are our key thinkers for today's Theory in Five. Before we unpack the criteria for just war, we must understand the two sections that a war can be judged on. The first section is in relation to the conditions needed for war to be allowed in the first place. And the second section is focused on once the war is approved, what rules should be followed during the events. Let's begin. These are the criteria that has to be met before we can hold a war. There are some extra points, but for revision purposes, the discussion will be centred on the following. There has to be a just cause. It has to be declared by legitimate authority. It has to be fought with the right intention. Each side should have a probability of success. And it should only be used as a last resort. Once this criteria has been ticked off, Augustine and Aquinas stated the two most important rules during the war effort. The harming of innocent civilians is abhorrent. This includes children, women, pregnant women, since the baby is unborn and a Christian will not be happy with that, the elderly, the disabled, and lastly, the means to fight the war must be proportionate to the ends. For example, investing billions of money into war machinery and killing millions of civilians may not always lead to the positive outcome intended. This again becomes quite utilitarian in nature, hence why war and utilitarianism are closely linked. Now, whether or not Christians and other religious groups follow the teachings of just war literally, it is important to remember that since most places of worship are against weapons of mass destruction anyway, they will not follow much of just war due to its complexities. Even during the time of history when just war was introduced as a theory, monarchs continued fighting, ignoring all guidance. This disregard of just war is what we are seeing today with Israel's attack on Palestine. So, there you have it. Just war in under 5 minutes. There is nothing that war has ever achieved that we could not better achieve without it. Havelock Ellis. Do you agree? Thank you for watching.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, it's fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your brother, my man, D-Sokaya. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. An episode coming at the conclusion, sort of me recovering from COVID. The second time I've had it. First time I was actually diagnosed with it, and man, wow. Oof, my word. I had compassion for the people dealing with it prior to this, even though, again, I'd had it once before, but I was never diagnosed, and I know I had it because of how I felt this time, and then I compared it to how I felt before, and it was a total match. Experience can either deepen or deny your compassion. It has deepened my compassion. Those being afflicted by COVID presently, man, you know, rest up and you'll get through it. On with the show. Condemning or condoning or the Martin Luther King approach to the Palestinian crisis, aka present ongoing genocide. This is my third attempt to record an episode about what took place on, I think it was February 28th, 2024. I'm recording this on March 1st, 2024. And what I'm referring to here is the Flower Massacre, as I have heard it been called. 100 people, presently I think the death count is at 112, people were slaughtered by what first appeared to be IDF gunfire. But then it took some time, was confirmed to not only be IDF gunfire, but also drone fire, and seems to be some possible mortar shells. I have watched numerous videos and commentaries and information sessions about this, about what happened that day. And by the time you receive this, I'll have watched and read some more. Every single time, I could feel the spirit bubble up in my stomach, needing to talk about this, needing to communicate about this. It took some time, because when I first heard about it, I was in mourning. And when I continued to hear about it, I became more and more mournful, because I could see a connection between what's happening in Palestine and the not too distant future that the United States is setting up for itself. But what really grasped me, what really caught me, was I happened to be taking in all this information while I was actually prepping the quote-unquote latest video, or excuse me, the latest podcast episode for Class 4 Better Foot Podcast, which was from the vault from back on, I recorded it on November 7th, 2023, and it was about the Israeli and Palestinian conflict back then, and how it was connected to the pandemic humanitarian rising that I talked about at the beginning of last year, 2023, and it was connected to this idea of a ruleless international order, which I came back to in another episode segment, which I've already produced. I was supposed to release it 2 months ago, but before I caught COVID, I caught a sinus infection, which moved down into my lungs, and it was not fun. And that stopped me from being able to release it then, but I will be releasing it shortly. I'm actually trying to finish up its partner episode segment before I release it to you. While I was working on that episode, I was listening to various news stories from around November 7th, 2023. And specifically, I found an interview with Netanyahu, where I believe it was ABC News, the anchor was talking to him about, at that time, the 10,000 people who had already been somewhat confirmed to be killed, because the health ministry was the one putting those numbers out. And so everybody started questioning if the health ministry was correct, because it was quote unquote Hamas led, even though, and I feel like I have to point this out. In a lot of countries, if you are not a member of the ruling party, you typically do not receive jobs in public life. Rather, that public life is political or it's administrative. Now, here in the United States, we try to act like we're different, but we're not. We're not. Even though, because how we do our political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, we typically obscure the ideological aspect of it. So we can get a Democrat who is ideologically conservative, who is appointed by a Republican because he's ideologically conservative, and we'll say, oh, well, that's bipartisan. When in fact, ideologically, it's not. It's unipartisan. Both sides have decidedly ostracized, to an extent, the left and progressives. So it's very seldom that you see a progressive or a leftist, a true leftist, get put into administrative office. And so when a true progressive or leftist is put into administrative office, they don't call that bipartisan. They call that a win for the people, because they know that in actuality in the United States, that is where the people actually are. They're more progressive. Now, I didn't mean to get off on that tangent, but it's important that you understand that. The United States faced this problem, this idea that somehow, you know, these cultures that they were going into and messing with their country structures, that they didn't have cultural norms where if you weren't part of the ruling party, you couldn't participate administratively in public life. The United States came crashing into that reality when it overthrew Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist Party. People had to join the Ba'athist Party in order to serve administratively at a local level in Iraq. So when the United States came in and said, we're kicking all the Ba'athists out because we don't like them, what they did, and you can go check the records, this is recorded. What they did was they literally tore apart the state from top, Saddam Hussein, all the way down to the roots, without a plan to replace those institutional structures that they were tearing apart. In fact, there were people who tried to warn the United States of this, including some of the Ba'athists, who were saying, listen, we're not really Ba'athists, but if we wanted to work administratively, we had to join the Ba'athist Party. And I'm sorry if I have the name incorrect, but I believe it is pronounced that way. The same is true with Hamas. There is no doubt in my mind that the same is true with Hamas. In order to do administrative work, which, by the way, and this needs to be pointed out, prior to October 7th, whenever the health ministry came out and said, hey, this number of people died, nobody, including the United States, questioned it. Why? Because health ministry is not political until you make it political on a local level. And there is no evidence suggesting that the people who are serving in the Palestinian health ministry, who in the Gaza Strip were Hamas, these people were not political. They had a public administrative job to do, and they did it. Now, there's something else that needs to be pointed out when we talk about this public job. And I apologize for being general here. I don't have time to get into massive amounts of speciality and because I don't know how to be that specific in this instance, so I'm going to be general. In a lot of Arab communities in the Middle East, there is a stigma around what we think of here in the United States as public works or public administrations. And the stigma is not negative. It's actually quite positive. Because of how their culture is so family and community centric, that comes from the days of tribal interweaving and tribal loyalties, and yet also the idea that tribes had to be at peace in order to hold together trade routes and administrative routes that went far beyond the tribe. But because of this, doing work for the community, doing work for what we call the public, is held at a high esteem. And if you play too much politics with that, not only does a group, a small group of people, lose respect for you, but the whole community does. And it is not very likely that you'll remain in that position long because of those long-standing traditions. Meaning what? You can talk about Hamas being problematic in the health ministry, but people are going to laugh at you because health is a universal need. And in their culture, a universal need is something that the divine, Muhammad, Allah, places the responsibility of meeting in the hearts of those that he calls to serve. And if you abuse that calling, you are not just abusing public trust. You are abusing public divinity. You are spitting in the face of Allah. And that is not tolerable. You will get ran out. Why do you think hospitals are so sacred to them? And I stress this. Why do you think hospitals are so sacred to them? I didn't say special. I didn't say held in high regard. No, these are sacred places because of the divinity in them. Quick story. I once had, I have a Middle Eastern doctor. It's wonderful. She's wonderful, but very busy. And I found out she did yoga, and she did it often. And I asked her about it. And, you know, we were having this back and forth about it. And I said to her, I go, you know, one of the things that drives me crazy about Western medication is they forget the spirit and the soul. And she looked up at me a little bit like, wait, what? And I'm like, I'm serious. They forget that inside this meat is the soul and the spirit. And she said, well, see, that's interesting that you know that. In my culture, we do not forget that. We know that there is divinity in this, that you are walking, talking, breathing spirit and soul. And so what I do is as much spiritual, as much built into the soul as it is physical. And I said, well, see, I get that, because that's the same thing with a lot of black doctors. We have that tradition where we can reach down and pull that notion of, okay, this is divinity, this is spirit, this is soul, when we're treating people. It's deeper than just public administration, is what I'm trying to tell y'all. It's deeper than that. But we, in this country, have been taught to see it as cold, callous, unfeeling, when it's deeper for them. And we have to understand it. Now, here's the funny thing is, most people expect that the health ministry's death totals are going to be a significant undercount. They believe, and this is coming from folks who have studied war, folks who have been a part of wars, folks who know their business. They believe that the number given by the health ministry is an undercount by possibly a couple of tens of thousands, if not more. It is possible that when all is said and done, we will find out that 10,000 or more Palestinians have been killed every single month that this war has waged on. And for those of you who aren't aware, I'm recording this on March 1st, 2024. In 6 days, well, it'll be technically a little bit more than 6 days because I forget what day they actually started their defensive or offensive on Gaza. We're going to be marking 5 months since this war began, so, or since this conflict began, since this genocide began. It is possible that 10,000 people have died every single month. And it's likely, because there are thousands missing. Thousands, not hundreds, thousands. Now, are those thousands in the tens of thousands yet? Or are they less than tens of thousands? Don't know. But when thinking about the criticisms that the, quote, Hamas-led health ministry has received, I was thinking about something that Larry Wilkerson said. Now, look, Larry Wilkerson is an old-school conservative diplomat. But to be fair, he's the only one talking in depth about these things, which goes to show you the left is not as prepared to administer policy as its commentators would like you to think they are. Who's really out there talking about international diplomacy from a democratic or left position? And I want to underscore here that they are not separate. They have to be placed together. But Larry Wilkerson, in an interview that I recently watched with him, he talked about the insanity, and he didn't use the word insanity, I'm using the word insanity, of how the United States has characterized its opponents in the last 30, 40 years. In the last 30, 35 years. It has never technically been about the states. It's always been about personalities. So the United States doesn't like Z. They want to, you know, be friends with China, but they just don't like the leader of China. The United States doesn't like Putin. They want to be friends with Russia, but they just don't like Putin. They don't like Hamas, but they want to be friends with the Palestinians, even though they've never really wanted to be friends with the Palestinians, they just don't like Hamas. And now we've even seen this stretched out to Netanyahu. Oh, Israel's fine. It's not Israel. It's Netanyahu. Of course, people in alternative media knows that's garbage. Because there are quote-unquote left-wing Zionists who are as bloodthirsty as the right-wing in Israel. And they'll tell you. They have no qualms about being like, oh yeah, we don't really care about those Palestinians. Let them starve. Let them they'll tell you. So, you know, this has actually all got me thinking. And the final kind of point that led me to this episode that I need to make comes from a number of interviews and a number of press conferences that I watched, including one from the State Department with this guy who just constantly looks so arrogant and is very dismissive of anybody who doesn't say that Israel is correct in slaughtering as many people as they want to slaughter. In that spokesman's back and forth with a, I believe he was a Palestinian journalist, but he was definitely from that region of the world. He asked point blank, why does the United States never say that they condemn anything that Israel has done? And he went out his way to toss up some terrible word salad that would have had the health department in his kitchen shutting him down because of the disgustedness of the food that he was producing, if that was literal food. And then he went to repeat something that internationally everybody has already knocked off the table. It's not even discussed because people have a living memory. He said, don't forget, one, Hamas brought this on to the Palestinians. He didn't say it that way, but he meant it that way. They brought it on to the Palestinians by attacking on October 7th, 2023. And number two, Hamas is bringing it continuously onto the Palestinians because they have embedded themselves into the population. Obviously, the global international community, the one that the United States always likes to cite, when they want to go out and do something, they've dismissed that. They don't believe that because they have a living memory. He also added that nothing that happened prior to October 7th can justify what happened on October 7th. Here I actually disagree with him. Oh, what, are you going to defend Hamas? This is the stupidity of people. And I say this with the nicest bit of reasoning that I can. Because folks don't study words, because folks just say things and expect them to all mean the same thing, they can call folks all kinds of names without ever having to explain it. What do I mean? Let's talk about the word justify. Let's talk about the word justify, because justify is not the same as support, though, if we look in the thesaurus, which is not a dictionary, the thesaurus will give you similes, words that could be categorized similarly for each word. And for justify, yes, there is a simile of support. But that is not what the word means. Now, yeah, you can look in dictionaries, and the dictionaries will say, well, you know, it'll be like the third or fourth or sixth or seventh one. Oh, well, just supporting what has been done. Incorrect. This is one of the most maddening things about English. English is a convoluted imperial language. It has never been structured correctly. And what I mean by structured correctly is a true studying of the words to find their roots and then to build from the root upward. There's actually scientific principles that you could use to find out what a lot of these words mean, and there's also metaphysical ones, but people don't do that because it's hard work. You'd actually have to put some real money into that. Anyway, let's talk about the word justify. The key word in justify is just, J-U-S-T. Now, the word just has a number of different roots to it, but I want to use the one that is most applicable here. Justice, or the idea of natural justice. Now, depending on what culture you are going to look at, a lot of cultures have what we would call differing opinions on what natural justice is, but the bulk of them, when you look at the bulk of cultures throughout the world, they all share similar principles and premises to what they would call natural justice. One of those principles and premises is retribution. Now, retribution itself has some interesting origins to it, but the key word to retribution is retribute. The key word to retribute is tribute. The idea of tribute is not Roman, even though that's kind of where we presently get the most common framing from, especially from a socio-political standpoint. The idea of tribute is to give to something. Is to give to something. Now, when you're talking about from a justice perspective, you are typically talking about a bigger body, let's call it, of water. So justice is water. It is the human spirit. It is the human consciousness. It is the capacity for the human spirit in totality to give energy to something to make it correct. That's what justice is about. It's about rebalancing. It's about healing. It's about resolving. It is about recouping. It is about bringing back into full alignment the activities and the standings in humanity. Okay? So, that body of, quote, water, that human spirit that I'm talking about, that hangs over society. It is both a part of humanity, but it is also apart from humanity. It is part of our collective consciousness. It is part of our collective soul. It is part of what makes us multidimensional beings. When there is a problem between human beings, it is our access to that body of energy that allows us to resolve those problems in nonviolent fashion, or to soothe over the wounds created by us trying to solve those problems with violence. When we start talking about justifying something, we are starting to talk about taking that beautiful, wonderful energy and pulling it through us, pulling it through our institutions within our society and our institutions within our communities in order to place that energy centrally focused in the middle of whatever conflict we are dealing with. A It takes energy. It takes time. Now, when we start, when we get back to the idea of retribution, oftentimes humanity operates from a level of ego. And when we operate from a level of ego, we aren't confronting the soul. We're not confronting, or excuse me, we're not consulting, not confronting. We are not consulting the soul. In fact, oftentimes we are confronting it. We are pushing it aside in order to do something which we are not looking at the positive or negative consequences of for the future. Now, there are times when that happens because there has been an affliction that has gone unnursed or untendered or uncared for. And that affliction, what we call, poisons the soul. It represses the soul and forces the ego forward, which acts what we think of as animalistically. This is all metaphysics right here. This is all metaphysics. Now, people might say, oh, well, this is just garbity gook. Sure, it's just garbity gook. You've had church elders who have literally written classics about what I'm talking about here. They just don't use some of the words that I use. So, when he says that nothing that happened prior to October 7th justifies what happened on October 7th, he's incorrect. From the moment that Hamas took office, there was a clock that was ticking in the cosmos. And that clock was not set to any timer, but it was keeping watch over the stuff that was happening in Gaza and keeping the score. What score are we talking about? We're talking about offenses. We're talking about innocent deaths. That is called the clock of the soul. The clock of the soul, don't forget. From the time Hamas took office, something, by the way, that the Israelis supported, to October 6, 2023, Israel killed, and this is not Hamas giving these numbers. Well, technically it was. It started out as Hamas giving these numbers, but the health administration gave these numbers, and nobody disputed them. Nobody disputed them. In fact, all of these were documented. All of these were confirmed. Israel killed over 6,000 innocent people in Gaza. 6,000. Now, that was over the course of, what, 16, 17 years? So, you know, it was less noticeable. But the soul doesn't forget. Every single one of those deaths, there was no resolution to them. That pressure built up. That pressure built up. Until finally, the cosmos came to realign the order. And on October 7th, after being warned several times that this was gonna take place, it did take place. Israel was hit. Now, we have to talk about retribution, because I explained to you the idea of tribute. But retribution is equally important. When you start dealing with acts against the soul, when you start dealing with acts against people's humanity, you start dealing with the exchanging of egotistical energies. And when violence is a part of that calculation, that pressure buildup from the side that is violated can become drastic if there is not a way to remove that energy and to dissipate it. That is where justice comes in. If there is no way to remove that energy, then you have to redistribute it. Now, redistribution either happens internally, so the group that is violated will turn the violence within themselves and execute it amongst themselves, or they'll seek revenge to redistribute the violated energy back to the people to which it came from. This is the idea of Dr. King's violence begets violence. The role of justice is to take that violative energy and to not just dissipate it, because energy, you can't destroy it. Even when you dissipate it, it's not destroyed. It's there. It is to replace it with something. And that something is a higher energy that changes the frequency of that violative energy and makes it constructive. You can do something with what justice turns it into. 6,000 people dead compared to 1,139. 55% of those 1,139 were military targets. It's a colony. That's going to happen, unfortunately. 45% were civilian. Inexcusable from a person like me, because I'm nonviolent. But I read history. When I look at what's happening in Israel and Palestine, I don't look at what's happening or what happened in the inner cities back in the 1980s or the early 1990s. I look at a book like Gerald Horn's book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. And I look at how the Native Indigenous population responded to the white man coming and taking their land. And I think about, what if that was happening in a modern day? How would the news media talk about a colony the United States had on some far-off continent that doesn't exist, you know, but let's say it existed. And the United States colony, which had been encroaching more and more and more and more on Native Indigenous land, killing Native Indigenous people, suddenly found themselves the, quote, victims of an attack by those Native Indigenous people. The news media would probably characterize it how it's characterizing what's happening in Palestine and Israel. Now, for many years, though, what the media would do was they would downplay the existence of Palestine. They would talk about Israel, and they would mention Gaza or the West Bank, but seldom would they mention that they supposedly belong to the same state of Palestine. The media would not mention the fact that the Palestinians were even a factor or even existed. They would talk about Gaza and the West Bank as two parcels of land that Israel was trying to get, quote, under control, basically. But back to the point. Retribution. Why retribution is powerful is because retribution doesn't have to match the original sin, the original problem. If the people are strong enough, and this is the magic behind nonviolent resistance. and why it takes so much violence to try and break nonviolence resistance. When the people are strong enough, what they do is they pull from this cosmic force, which we call justice. And they transmute the violative energies that they are being inflicted by. They transmute them back to that big old cosmic lake of just energy. And in exchange for transmuting those violative energies back to the cosmos, which can soothe them, solve them, and make them non-burdensome, they receive more just energies, which is important. Because then, instead of hitting the other side, with violence, they can take that newly gained energy and they can do constructive things with it. This is part of the process which enabled black people to prosper in many ways under segregation, because black people utilized to a great extent this retribution process. They took violative energies, which was often violence communicatively, interpersonally, and they transmuted it using justice. They transmuted it using justice. Now again, the idea here is not for me to condone what happened on October 7th, but it needs to be explained. Oh, but you don't condemn it, so you must support. Oh, come on, guys, grow up. Grow up. I mean, for Christ's sake. I mean, let's use this same principle on the United States. The United States typically does not condemn what people it supports does. And this has been a strategy of the United States for a long time. If they support you, they're not necessarily going to condemn you. They don't have to condone you, but they're not going to condemn you. A great example of this is when Saddam Hussein was their friend. The United States didn't condemn anything he was doing. Sure, they would say, well, you know, that's an internal thing that's going on in Iraq, and, you know, it's our policy not to really get involved, but we would hope that, yada, yada, yada. But they wouldn't condemn them. We never said that the United States was condoning what Iraq did during those days, what Saddam Hussein and his death squads did. In fact, when the left, the true left, was like, yeah, the U.S. is just condoning this, the United States absolutely dismissed that. That's ridiculous. We aren't condoning this. Now, granted, years later, we found out that the weapons and the bioweapons that he was using, well, it came from the United States, so it's what it is. The point is this, ladies and gentlemen. Explaining it isn't condoning it. Explaining it isn't condoning it. It's not even close to condoning it. We are all trying, supposedly, all of us are trying to get to a position where Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and harmony. Well, in order to do that, you got to tell the truth about where you're at and how you got there. Telling that truth isn't condoning it or condemning it. It is telling the truth. Now, if you want to be in the camp where the Israelis do nothing wrong, the Israelis, because of the Holocaust, they get a free pass, they can do whatever they want, they can't do anything wrong, I'm sorry, then you're not really working for the same thing I'm working for. You are trying, I don't actually know what you're trying to do. You're trying to build an Israeli state without telling people that you're building an Israeli state. You're trying to allow for one side to be vicious and brutal and colonialist and murderous without saying that that's wrong and that's adding to the problems, while saying that the other side, who is constantly being brutalized and abused and savaged, has no recourse, because not only are you saying that Israel has a right to defend itself by offending Palestinians, but you refuse to give them, the Palestinians, the international marquee of a state which will allow them to have proper representation in the United Nations, where they can then bring all of the abuses that they are suffering under the hands of their colonizers before the international community, who, by the way, are already well aware of that stuff and have been trying unsuccessfully because of the United States and the Eurocentric hegemonic model, trying to rectify the problem for several decades now. Me and you aren't working towards the same end. Now, if you want to tell the truth about it, Israel is there as a colonial settler project, which allows the colonial settler masters, the Europeans, to have access to a region which they deem strategically important. And through that access, they can, in part, control the region so that they can keep extracting whatever they want to extract from the region. And this extends into Africa. You and I aren't working for peace, at least not the same sort of peace. You want the absence of negative tension. I want justice to reign supreme. You want the absence of negative tension so you can keep exploiting the people. I want justice to reign supreme so the people can live in harmony and grow to be greater than they are now. We're working for two very different things. Two very different things. I started off this episode talking about condemning and condoning. It is a fine line between justifying something on metaphysical terms and excusing something in support of it. While that line is fine, it's notable and noticeable, and you can see it. The United States, unfortunately, understands this and likes to blur the line. Because while we're operating from just principles and just premises, that's justice-based principles and justice-based premises, we are not operating from a support of Hamas. We are operating from a basis of a humanitarian rising, of humanity rising to the occasion to finally stop these colonial conflicts and colonial wars. If Dr. King was here, this is the perspective he would take. This is the perspective he would take. And it's the perspective that everybody who says every year, oh, I would have supported Dr. King, he's the greatest man ever, most of y'all would have never supported Dr. King. The moment he came out against the Vietnam War, Dr. King lost so much white liberal support that it was sad. That it was sad. Nancy Pelosi, you wouldn't have supported Dr. King when he came out against the Vietnam War. Chuck Schumer, you wouldn't have supported Dr. King when he came out against the Vietnam War. Joe Scarborough, you wouldn't have supported Dr. King when he came out against the Vietnam War. Neither would you, Brzezinski. Most of you would have not. Oh, but how do you know? You don't know what's in our hearts. I listen to what you say about this. And I can match what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in Palestine, to what happened in Vietnam. Now, I'm almost done here, but I got to make this statement because there's going to be people who say, but Dr. King supported Israel. I don't know if we're ever going to get to see it, and I hope we would. But I'm learning quickly that Dr. King was a smart man publicly. He could measure sometimes what the public was ready for. And there is significant evidence now that Dr. King had always been against the Vietnam War. I found a statement from SCLC from 1965 about the Vietnam War where they didn't condemn it, but they didn't condone it. And it's apparent from books that I've read, articles that I've read, people who I've talked to who are familiar with Dr. King, that Dr. King was having detailed discussions about Vietnam years before he actually delivered Beyond Vietnam. Meaning what? Publicly, yeah, Dr. King supported Israel. But privately, Dr. King probably was far more thoroughly critical of Israel than we know about. I'm hoping someday we'll find out how critical. If you have any questions or comments or concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vimeo Diesel Gaia. Find every episode, especially the recent ones, of Class War Battlefield Podcast. Find me on radio4ALL.net, radio4ALL.net. You can also find me on Spotify, Amazon Music, various other places. If you really want to reach out to me, Class War Battlefield on Facebook, share it. Also, check out my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast. I'm all over the place, y'all. I'm, you know, where I'm at. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, CWB Podcast, PayPal, Cash App, you know, help out wherever you can. Additionally, shout out to Dr. Obatashaka, OBATSHAKA, the blackest show, YouTube show, on YouTube. Shout out to Black Power Media, to Dr. Karen Hunter, Dr. Greg Carr in Class with Carr, Roland Martin Unfiltered, all my people, man. Millennials Are Killing Capitalism, the Benjamin Diction Show. There's some other people. I know I'm forgetting it, and I'm sorry about that. But, you know, big shout out to all y'all. Obviously, shout out to the Professional Left Podcast, the best podcast you should be listening to. They just published their latest Scientific University episode, which you should definitely check out. Not my cup of tea, but it's still And Science Fiction University is a good podcast. The latest one wasn't my cup of tea. I listened to it. I liked it. And in fact, they probably convinced me to go and watch a movie that I didn't know I wanted to watch. But, okay, I guess it really was kind of my cup of tea. I enjoyed it enough to want to watch the movies. You know something? I retract my previous statement. I apologize. Anyway, real-time commentating right here. Shout out to Christopher Titus's Armageddon Uptake. Great name. Keith Olbermann, Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Big up, obviously. He just lost his brother. So, you know, man, take care of yourself. Take care of yourself, brother Keith Olbermann, you know. Thinking about you. I lost my brother back in 2020. You know, takes a toll. So, you know, God bless you. Big shout out to Majority Report, to Humanist Report, to Secular Talk, to Rational National. There's a lot of them. There's just a lot of them. Chris Hedges Report. Really, Chris Hedges Report is phenomenal. Chris Hedges Report is phenomenal. Go check him out. Anyway, I am your brother, Brian Meredith Ogaya, and I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance. Overman, Gaza, and the campus protests. So, earlier in the week, and I'm recording this on May 17, 2024, earlier in the week, actually I think it was last week now, Keith Olbermann quickly made a statement about why he was not really covering the campus protests. He said it was because a recent poll came out, I think it was a Harvard poll came out, and that poll said that they had discovered that only about 2% of young people polled cared about Gaza. He also made a mention that that same poll found that people cared the most about the economy, and the second most, or not even, I don't even know what's second most, but about 16% of them, and by the way, 27% cared about the economy, 16% cared about climate change. I was admittedly frustrated and a little pissed off about the use of this BS poll. And let's be very clear, it's a BS poll. I wrote a comment on the podcast where Mr. Overman talked about this. I wrote a comment saying, you know, look, I want to know who were the people that they actually polled and how many did they poll, where did they live, things like that, because all of that's going to play an important role. I imagine if you, a lot of the people at Harvard, don't give two craps about what's happening in Gaza. I also imagine that a lot of them care more about their jobs than climate change. But if you're in a frontline community, like a lot of people at Harvard are not, climate change and the environment are very important. Now, granted, I think most young people are going to say economy first, because one, we are raised in a society where economy is forefront, and economy means job. That is not where the word economy technically comes from, but fine, it means job. It means, what can I put on my table? We live in a society where that is given an oversized importance. Literally, people are praised for working 80, 90 hours a week, sacrificing their health, sacrificing the well-being of their children, sacrificing the well-being of their families. We give them kudos for that. I think it's a mistake, but that's what we do. Now, mind you, there was no follow-up question to discover what people meant by economy. Because a lot of young people do care about the economy, and it is of the foremost topic in their mind, but other polls have found that young people, particularly those in their early 20s, look at economy a little bit differently. They want jobs that give them more time to be with their friends and their families. They don't see the importance of working themselves into an early grave just so some rich person can get richer. They care about what they're getting paid. And they no longer value this nonsense that, oh, well, making no money just so somebody else can make it is fair. They care about how they're treated by their jobs. A lot of jobs treat them like human resources. They're not for that. They're not materials that can be tossed away. So the question of what do you mean by economy wasn't raised. The climate change one told me immediately that this was a nonsense poll. Since time after time, major polls of tens of thousands of young people have shown climate change is up there, and it's not 16%. It's well over a third, and sometimes even heading into the 40s. Percentage-wise, I mean. But this isn't just about that. Because I don't want to get off on this tangent. I'll spend the next half an hour ripping apart those numbers. But after I thought about it, really what Mr. Overman does and how he did jump into the entire Gaza thing early on, and to be honest with you, was taken for a ride. I realized people like Mr. Overman should not necessarily be commenting on all of this, because that's not the place that they need to be. That's not the best role that they can play. Mr. Overman, who is a liberal capitalist, he's kind of a progressive liberal capitalist, but he is a liberal capitalist who does have a heart and does genuinely not want to see people hurt by this system that we live in. He is best when he is commenting on the political realities of the of this dying empire. Now, he does not have the type of worldview that enables him to not only contextually place something like Gaza in what is happening there, but also to see how what has been happening internationally within the American empire is now coming home to roost negatively. And that's because the liberal side of that whole liberal capitalist is institutionalist. Mr. Oberman's been an institutionalist his whole life. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. In any great reformist and even revolutionary movement, you've needed institutionalists, people who understood the institutions. You needed people who not only understood the institutions, but how they operated and thus how you could change things. Most people, when they start talking about reform or how things need to change, they do so strictly from an outsider's perspective. They don't want to listen to people who were careerists because they see the careerists as the enemy. Mr. Oberman is a clear-cut example of a careerist and an institutionalist who sees the need for reformation. First, he sees the need for significant reform. For that reason, you have to understand, as I had to understand, where he's coming from. He does not mean to offend, and this isn't me defending him. This is me explaining to you the mind state of a liberal who is, at their core, an institutionalist. He doesn't mean to offend. It is just the worldview. And I had to understand that. He is his best when he is literally calling the political madness. That's what he does best. He also, because he is a liberal, has that moral center that, though it may not go far enough for people like me, it goes far enough for a liberal. And therefore, people like me who want to see greater change, we have to accept the fact that progressive liberals are only going to ever go so far because they are institutionalists. Now, the key challenge to a progressive liberal, because they are institutionalists, is to offer up their wisdom of institutional building to those who are seeking to build reformist institutions. Many people in Mr. Oberman's position don't do that. They don't do that. They give career advice, but they do not give advice when it comes to building institutions that could have within those institutions the lessons learned, the values instilled that were not instilled from the previous institution and from their working in those institutions. We have to realize, and many of us have not, when we are talking about the media's ecosystem, we are talking about a field that seeks and needs diversity of positionality. I'm a big football person. So when I think about a field in positionality, I think about it in terms of offense, defense. Not everybody is the quarterback. Some people need to stick to being a guard. Some people need to stick to being a tight end. Some people need to stick to being a wide receiver. It doesn't diminish their contributions to the team or to the team effort. It actually enhances the team's ability to achieve their objectives if they learn those positions thoroughly. Mr. Oberman has his position down packed. For some people, they wonder why is he solely focused on Donald Trump. He would say it's because Donald Trump poses the greatest threat to democracy in this country. He would be right. The question that he does not answer, he does periodically, but the question that he does not answer is why? And it's because, just like every tip of the spear, there is something behind him that is driving him forward. If Mr. Oberman chooses to ever make a statement about the campus protests, fine. But if he doesn't, that's also fine. We need him doing what he's doing, and we need as much of it as possible. We need as much of it as possible. We do. Because ultimately, what he's doing is so vital to what the rest of the media ecosystem is doing, that if he were not doing it, the other parts would suffer. And I mean that sincerely. From what is becoming a rapidly growing, what we think of as independent news environment, we will build new institutions that will not only rival, but I will tell you, they will overtake these dinosaurs. The question that we must answer is, when are we going to do it? Mr. Oberman is an important part in that new trajectory. Thank you for listening. This is the end of the CWB podcast note. Thank you for listening to the Class War Battlefield podcast, episode 2023.0D.04, published on May 20th, 2024. The references contained in today's episode include clip 1 at the 1:55 mark, originally published on February 29th, 2024 by the Internet Archive. Democracy Now, Thursday, February 29th, 2024. Clip 2, at the 3:24 mark, originally published on January 21st, 2019 by the United Nations YouTube channel, Martin Luther King at the UN for an anti-Vietnam War demonstration, 15 April 1967. Clip 3, at the 12:48 mark, originally published on February 29th, 2024, by the Young Turks YouTube channel, 100 plus dead after Israeli troops open fire on desperate Palestinians in food lines. Clip 4, at the 25:22 mark, originally published on January 8th, 2020, by the TEDx Talks YouTube channel, Why Do We Make War? Hector Garcia's TEDx San Antonio. Clip 5. At the 38-minute, 48-second mark, originally published on August 30th, 2019, by the Manufacturing Intellect YouTube channel, Young Benjamin Netanyahu on Palestine, 1978. Clip 6. At the 48-minute and 48-second mark, originally published on May 19th, 2021, by the Theory in 5 YouTube channel, Just War in Under 5 Minutes, Theory in 5. You can find a complete listing of these resources with links included by going to my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast, all one word. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you on the next one.